Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. Welcome back to Reclaiming the Republic. We are going through the Virginia ratification debate, and as you know, there's a lot of meat here. One of the things that I've been pondering, because I think we've already had Mason talk about a cauldron or, you know, the dark evils within the DC for, you know, casting evil spirits and spells and so forth, because Congress will have exclusive legislation to do what they need. And so I think there's merit in taking a quick second in understanding the paradigm of the time. Now, of course, when anybody is out trying to sell something, you have to be really careful. You don't cross the line and offer too much. Like, we're going to, if this car breaks at any point in time, we're going to fix it. And if that gets written down, then if that car breaks at any time, there's no qualifications for what's broken or what, then the dealership would be obligated to fix it. Like I said, especially if it's written down, or if it happens to be recorded in a video conversation or what have you, right? Because it's legally binding. Anything you say to help persuade somebody's commitment or acknowledgement and acceptance of a contract, that becomes legally binding. On the flip side, you can say almost anything you want to keep people from signing that, using superstition, using, hyperbolic speech, rhetoric, what have you. So when you look at the anti-federalists, there's no edge to how far they can go. They can go as far as they want in making the most absolute and asinine types of assertions that's going to happen. So this is why we find that, Mason and some of these folks are making such contradictory, or not even contradictory, I'll just call them outlandish arguments and assertions. Well, back in those days, when it came down to talking about evil spirits, evil spells, and that type of thing, they didn't have the empirical data that we have today. Not that there isn't such a thing as evil and the influence of evil, and that, there are some kinds of powers, but the fact of the matter is, back in those days, they were far more superstitious, and they gave far too much credit to doers of evil. I mean, it's one thing for people to collude, work together, and, get things done, but it's another thing for them to actually, create a modern-day Job. In other words, if you read the Bible and that Job was tempted and inflicted by Satan to, suffer at his hand, well, that's because the Lord allowed that. And so there is some indemnity between us and Satan, but nevertheless, the fact of the matter is that most people back in those days, they were burning witches. I mean, it's not so long since they, were throwing a duck in the water and a person in the water, and they would burn the person kind of thing. And so they were susceptible to those types of things. Now, they understood certain behavior as evil. And one of the things that they used as a real hyperbolic, assertion was when somebody started talking about welfare, education, and providing those types of things, because they were really adamant at this point in time in maintaining and I'm going to use the word separation of church and state. They were really adamant that the state not get in the business of dictating religion, that religion was a separate entity, and that religion was a tool that the state or church, or I should say the government, used in providing the compassionate services, you know, the welfare, you know, feeding of the employment assistance, those types of things. That's where people got their community help and guidance, was from the church. So there was a symbiotic relationship, but it was really a almost like a one-way relationship, where the state never went down the path of trying to dictate religion and trying to profess religion. Well, as we created, as we progressed as a nation in delineating a more defined and a more defined line, to a point where we removed churches' involvement in the community for compassionate services, that's when the state started to making its move towards edicting or actually promoting and putting forth their own dogma. Because it was in the 1850s to beyond when they started taking over education, started taking over, you know, community involvement and so forth. And the church still had some activities, but as the church was relieved of, you know, having to do school because the state started taking that over, because they knew if they started teaching the kids, they could slowly migrate them away from the religious dogma towards the godless secular dogma that was going to be coming down from the federal government, or from the government itself, state, federal, and so forth. And so as we kind of meandered down this road from the 1850s into the 1950s, we'll actually see events transpire, like the Scopes trial of 1920. And even before that, we'll start seeing how the churches start losing more and more of its grasp. If you look at what the church was providing, I mean, why is it that the best health hospitals have religious names? St. Mary's, St. Joseph's, Zion's. Why is that? It's because the churches were providing health care as well. And so as everything moved away and basically gave church very little control over these things, because government assumed the control over all these things, then you see the establishment of the godless secular church. And that was it a big conspiracy? No, but it was a direction that we were put on by people that knew what they were doing, that was going to create this empowerment of this, I'll just say, evil. Now, when I say evil, I'm not using hyperbole. I am actually speaking of, you know, a very direct result, because what has happened when the federal government starts making laws in respect to religion, that thou shalt not be able to teach creation in school. That's a law respecting religion. It violates the First Amendment. They can't make any law respecting religion, period. But they did. Oh, but they didn't make it a law because it was the Supreme Court that edicted that. It's the same thing. And I'm here to tell you that it wasn't like it was this obvious conspiracy. It was a very, you know, let's just say methodical process that they all worked for. And Hugo Black did his job. He was the one that, in I forget which one it was, that he was the one that stated there needs to be a wall of separation between church and state, while they were establishing a godless secular state church. Milton Friedman points this out in his book, Free to Choose. So anyway, as we're going through this, we're going to see this type of hyperbole from Mason and those types of men. As you know, the show is also sponsored by RepublicReview.org, and this still is the only show that gives you academic evidence and the academic-based solutions of what we must do if we're going to save our liberty and our Constitution. I will say this. I just threw it out there into a Wyoming form because they're seeing that there's already 10 candidates running for the House of Representatives challenging Liz Cheney. And when you have a condition like that, you've created a condition that is in support of Liz Cheney. So what I did was I threw out this comment regarding Section 3 of the 14th Amendment and that everybody needs to start challenging her qualifications and put it at a public record and make her be the first victim of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. Maybe not by a legal ruling, but by the consensus of the people that she does not deserve to be a public servant because she deliberately ignored her responsibility as a public servant in going, you know, in supporting the Constitution. I mean, if you understand Section 3, you have to support the Constitution. Well, the Constitution says that if we're under an invasion, then Congress has the obligation to protect us. They have failed to protect us over three decades of an invasion on our southern border. And what does it say in the Constitution? If we're under an invasion, Congress shall have the power to call forth a militia. Well, okay, so they call it the National Guard. I say it's unconstitutional, but that's what they say. So they're obligated to use the National Guard on that southern border to beef it up and give it all the support. And they have failed to do their job in stopping this invasion and not allowing people to cross that line. In other words, they've basically changed that border to being any inch on that border is a point of immigration. Like there's a little pad there where you can sign up and say, I want to become an immigrant, and then fill the, you know, rip the paper off the pad and come on in and say, here's my application. That would be immigration, but what they're doing is they're flagrantly violating our laws and invading us. We'll be right back after these two promos.
Take the time to watch our presentation on YouTube that provided an irrefutable argument of what we have to do to save our Constitution and our Republic. I know it's over an hour and 30 minutes, but you only need to watch the first 30 minutes. If you take the time to watch this presentation, I promise it will change your paradigm regarding what our Constitution is and what we have to do if we are going to save it, our liberties, our sovereignty, and our republic. We already have answers to most of the questions that you might think of after watching this presentation, and we want to help you get to a point where you have a profound understanding of the audit and republic review process. This is why our bullet overview and flowchart of both the argument and process is available on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. The sooner you get informed, the sooner you can get involved and make an impact. So go to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org to the Take Action page. That's where you'll find the video. Thank you so much.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay, so if you're wondering, I'm still planning on going to Red Pill Expo. So we're hoping that we can get a lot of state legislatures. The only way we're going to get state legislatures to start getting involved is not by my emails, but by everybody getting involved. And so what you need to do, and I hate to do this, but you need to sign up for my emails that I send to state legislators. And more importantly, if I don't have your state legislative email addresses, then I need your help so that we can get these emails to them. The reason being is the day is coming very quickly when all of a sudden the federal government is going to say, well, for this reason or another reason, this financial meltdown, and that's probably what it'll be, has basically made it impossible for us to service our debt. We're so far in the red that there's nothing we can do, and we're going to have to throw away our Constitution. This is where the states, I've been telling the states, that debt, we're not constitutionally obligated. And that's a very dangerous message that the states need to send to the federal government so that the federal government understands that now the states know that they are deliberately doing what they're doing to destroy our constitutional republic. There you go. And when they communicate that we're not obligated, when the state legislators communicate we're not obligated to pay that debt, those people who are responsible for creating the debt, if they are still alive, will be provided as the payment to China and the rest of the world so that those nations can get their pound of flesh from them. And then they should be sending a very clear and concise message. Cease and desist all debt and start accounting for what you have constitutionally spent money on via the enumerated powers and all the money over the last two centuries that you have spent money on that was not within the enumerated powers. You're going to find that the entire debt will be consumed in addition to, you know, the legitimate money. So in other words, we've been able to actually support ourselves legitimately the whole time. Back when Wilson created the 16th Amendment, they were already spending money on things that they had no constitutional authority to do so. They've been violating the Constitution since they started pouring money into the railroad system and the agricultural system and, you know, the interior, as they started creating the Department of Interior and they created the Department of Agriculture and so forth and so on. All the money that they've been spending on these domestic issues have been violations of the Constitution. And so what we want to do is we want to make sure that you're aware of that so that they draw that line. And in so doing, they are basically letting the federal government know that they are about to have an epoch. An epoch is the beginning of a new standard and a new time frame and a new, from this point, direction moving forward. So with that, hey, we have our comment line, 425-270-5416. Now, our first up in the barrel is George Mason, the anti-federalist, and he starts talking about the sweeping clause. And he says, Mr. Gentleman, says there is, it's Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, Mr. Gentleman, Mr. Chairman, gentlemen say there is no power given by this clause. Is there anything in this Constitution which secures to the states powers which are said to be retained? Will powers remain to the states which are not expressly guarded and reserved? Now, let me ask you something. When you're working with a specified or an enumerated power of attorney, do you actually have these conversations that, you know, hey, it doesn't say that all your powers are retained, so it means that I can start playing with it? No. It's very clear. These are the only powers you have. Why is he going down this path? Again, he is using hyperbole. I will suppose a case. Gentlemen may call it an impossible case and suppose that Congress will act with wisdom and integrity. Among the enumerated powers, Congress are to lay taxes, duties, and imposts and excise, and to pay the debts and provide for the general welfare and defense. And by that clause, so often called the sweeping clause, they are to make all laws necessary to those laws. Now, what he just did was he read the preamble, then he went to the bottom of Section 8 and read the sweeping clause, which is the necessary and proper clause to carry forth the foregoing powers. Now suppose oppressions would arise under this government and any writer should dare to stand forth and expose to the community at large the abuses of those powers. Could not Congress, under the idea of providing for the general welfare and under the own construction, say that this was destroying the general peace and encouraging sedition and poisoning the minds of the people, and they could not, in order to provide this, lay a dangerous restriction on the press? Might they not bring the trial of this restriction within the 10 miles? Then, when there is no prohibition against it, might they not thus destroy the trial by jury? Would they not extend their implication? It appears to me that they may and will and shall. The support of our rights depend on the bounty of men whose interest it may be to oppress us, that Congress should have the power to provide for the general welfare of the Union, I grant, but I wish a clause in the Constitution with respect to all powers which are not granted, that they are to be retained by the states. Otherwise, the power of providing for the general welfare may be perverted to its destruction. Many gentlemen whom I respect take different sides of this question. We wish this amendment to be introduced to remove our apprehensions. There was a clause in the Confederation reserving the states respectively every power, jurisdiction, or right not expressly delegated to the United States. This clause has never been complained of, but approved by all. Why not then have a similar clause in this construction in which it is more indispensable and necessary than in the Confederation because of the great augmentation power vested in the former? In my humble apprehension, unless there be some clear and finite expression, this clause now under construction will go to anything our rulers may think proper, unless there be some express declaration that everything not given is retained, it will be carried to any power Congress may please. Now, George Nicholas then responds, Henry that read and moved to read the declaration from the 8th to the 13th article of the Declaration of Rights, which was done. And so this is Mr. Nicholas's response. In reply to the gentleman opposed to the clause under debate, went over some grounds and developed the same principles which Mr. Pendleton and Mr. Madison had done. The opposers of the clause, which gave the power of providing for the general welfare, supposed its dangers to result from its connection with and the extension of powers granted in the other clauses. He endeavored to show the committee that it only empowered Congress to make laws as would be necessary to enable them to pay the public debts, to provide for the common defense, that this general welfare was united not on the general power of legislation, but to the particular power of laying and collecting taxes, imposts, and excises for the purpose of paying the debts and providing for the common defense. That is, that they could raise as much money as would pay the debts and provide for the common defense in consequence of this power. Not pay for social engineering, not pay for health care, not pay for energy, not pay for education, not pay for labor, not pay for housing and health and human services and homeland security and the FBI and the ATF and the BLM and on and on and on and on. Only the enumerated powers. The clause which was affected, called the sweeping clause, contained no grant of new power. To illustrate this position, he observed that if it had been added at the end of every one of the enumerated powers instead of being inserted at the end of all, it would be obvious to anyone that it was no augmentation of power. If, for instance, at the end of the clause granting power to lay collect taxes had been added, they should have power to make necessary and proper laws to lay and collect taxes. Who could suspect it to be an addition of power, as it would grant to no new power if inserted at the end of the clause? It could not be subjoined to the whole. And so, as you can see, Mr. Mason was trying to make these connections. Now, I'm going to tell you that there are and have been judges that have come right out and have made comment regarding the necessary and proper clause, as well as the general welfare clause, and granting the federal government powers that have been completely injected by imagination and not through the process. Again, if you have an enumerated, a specified power of attorney, you cannot start granting yourself powers. The only powers you have there are the powers that are listed, the powers that have been provided in that power of attorney, period. So Mr. Henry, now I try not to get into the anti-federalist so much, but Mr. Henry's going to talk about common law. So when we come back from the break, we're going to have these conversations real quick on common law and declaring common law the law to be enforced in the land. Anyway, we'll be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much. Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcasts and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Moby Strip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Moby Strip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you. To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath, even though we're not required to take it, because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station. Don't forget, you can call our 24-hour comment line to ask a question or to speak on any topic. Dial 425-270-5416. Okay, now we're going to go to Mr. Henry. And these are just short because I've said before, this actually isn't a real long oration, but this is an indictment coming from Mr. Henry. I want to make sure it's not that long of an oration. It's about a page and a half. So anyway, Mr. Henry makes a real indictment because he points to common law. And he also brings up this lack of a Bill of Rights. I mean, they beat the Federalists and those who are promoting the Constitution with the fact that there is no Bill of Rights. And everything he talks about, I truly believe, and as a matter of fact, I think that the empirical data actually supports this concept that if they wouldn't have had the Bill of Rights, the state legislators would have been far more valiant in making sure that the people knew that we had an enumerated constitution, the first of its kind, that it granted no general powers, that the only powers that they had were these very specific listed powers, that the preamble in Section 8 was just that, a preamble. Anywho, because why did they list the powers of collecting and paying debts and then actually identify the taxation and the uniformity and so forth and so on in the list of powers? And that's why Madison, and it was brought up a few times, that the whole preamble would be worthless if those were actually granted powers, because not the preamble would be worthless, because of the preamble, what they did was they actually listed the powers, and he points out that why would they go to the trouble of listing powers when they create this tenor? The whole point of the preamble was to create a tone of why they are granting these powers, and then they provided the powers. Now, maybe what we want to do is just, you know, strike out the preambles, because when, you know, they start to set this tone, most people think that those are general powers when that was never the intent. And they prove that that was never the intent. But Mr. Henry is about to say, what barriers have you to oppose the most strong, energetic government? To that government, you have nothing to oppose. All your defense is given up. This is a real, actual defect. It must strike the mind of every gentleman. When our government was first instituted in Virginia, we declared the common law of the law of England to be in force. That system of law, which has been admired and has protected us and our ancestors, is excluded by that system. Added to this, we adopted a Bill of Rights. By this Constitution, some of the best barriers of human rights are thrown away. Is there not an additional reason to have a Bill of Rights? By the ancient common law, the trial of facts is decided by a jury of impartial men from the immediate vicinage. This paper speaks of different juries from the common law in criminal cases and in civil controversies, excludes trial by jury altogether. There is therefore more occasion for supplementary check of a Bill of Rights now than then. When he says now than then, he's talking about then the bill in the Articles of Confederation. Is it not this sufficient to alarm men? How different is this from the immemorial practice of your British ancestors and your own? I need not tell you that by the common law, a number of hundredors were required on a jury, and that the afterwards it was sufficient if the jurors came from the same county. With less than this, the people of England have never been satisfied. The paper ought to have declared the common law in force. He's talking about the paper, the Constitution. He was very derogatory towards the Constitution. I wonder how Mr. Henry thinks now of this Constitution. Did he ever obtain any respect from this product? I mean, he looked at it as if it was a work of evil. And everyone else, all the framers, all the good men that worked on this, and the first session of Congress, both the House and the Senate, unanimously called for a day of giving service and thanks to the divine hand of Providence for giving us this Constitution. I mean, there was absolutely reverence towards this Constitution. And here is a man belittling and marginalizing. Anyway, I just give you that. Anybody out there that's a real lover of Patrick Henry, he had his place in history, but he lost his place in, as far as in my perspective, when he started fighting, because he was the problem. He was the state cabal in Virginia. He was a big part of that cabal that wanted to maintain power so that there would be no real energetic union, so that eventually France would come. And we've gone through this. The France would come here and it would conquer America with Britain and Spain at their aid. And they would just divide us and conquer us. And then the next thing you know, we would be struggling just like Europe is today, because Europe has just been waged with war constantly, because the borders have ebbed and flowed one way or the other by whoever has in power or whoever has had in treatment and what's a good word for it? I don't want to say espionage, but the word is intrigue. Yeah, there it is. Because, oh, well, these people are needing, you know, just like what Germany did. I mean, their intrigue was to pursue the lands next to them so that they could feed themselves. That's how the First World War started. They couldn't feed themselves because of the failed collapse of socialism. Because everything was moved to the state and there was no more family farming, at least in essence, by socialism, everything became state-run. And so they had a real hard time. And socialism and communism and dictatorships has caused more death and destruction than anything else in Europe. But anyway, Mr. Henry goes on and says, in this business of legislation, your members of Congress will lose the restriction, if not imposing excessive fines, demanding excessive bail, and inflicting cruel and unusual punishments. These are prohibited by your Declaration of Rights. What has distinguished our ancestors? That they would not admit of tortures or cruel and barbarous punishments. But the Congress may introduce the practice of civil law in preference to that of common law. Now, that's not what happened, and that's not because at the point in time, you'll find that common law was not, or civil law, it was left to a state. States had the option. It was to the states to determine which laws they choose. It was kind of like the federal government, or I should say the general government, was not going to have any favors towards religion or any favors towards law. Anyway, this is what George Nicholas answered. In answer to the two gentlemen last up, observed that there was a Declaration of Rights in the government of Virginia. It was no conclusive reason that there should be one in this Constitution. For, if it was unnecessary in the former, its omission in the latter could be no defect. In other words, there was no Declaration of Rights in the Articles of Confederation, so how could it be a defect in this one? They ought therefore to prove that it was essentially necessary to be inserted in the Constitution of Virginia. There were five or six states in the Union which had no Bill of Rights, separately and distinctly as such, but they annexed the substance of a Bill of Rights to their respective constitutions. These states, he further observed, were as free as this state and their liberties as secure as ours. If so, gentlemen's argument from the precedent were not good. In Virginia, all powers were given to the government without any exception. It was different in the general government, to which certain powers were delegated for certain purposes. He asked which was more safe. Was it safer to grant general powers than certain limited powers? This much as to the theory, he continued. What is the practice of this invaluable government? Have your citizens been bound by it? They have not, sir. You have not violated that maxim, quote, that no man shall be condemned without a fair trial, close quote. That man who was killed, and actually, when I say this, I want to make sure because I thought I heard something different. This is George Nicholas actually proving that this Bill of Rights has not really served them, because he says, you have violated that maxim, quote, that no man shall be condemned without a fair trial, close quote. That man who was killed, not secundum artem, was deprived of his life without the benefit of law, and in express violation of this Declaration of Rights, which they confided in so much. But, sir, this Bill of Rights was no security. It was but a paper check. It had been violated in many other instances. Therefore, from theory and practice, it may be concluded that this government, with special powers, without any express exceptions, is better than a government with general powers and special exceptions. But the practice of England is against us. The rights they're reserved to the people are to limit and check the king's prerogative. It is easier to enumerate the exceptions to his prerogative than to mention all the cases in which it extends. Besides, these reservations being only formed in acts of the legislature may be altered by the representatives of the people when they think proper. No comparison can be made of this with the other governments he mentioned. There is no stipulation between the king and the people. The former is possessed of absolute unlimited authority. We'll be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much. If you run a business or an organization, you already know email is an essential tool for communicating. If you're interested in reducing your overhead and increasing your productivity, I personally recommend you look into AdLocal email marketing services. AdLocal has a special offer for my listeners with email services that start at $10 a month for your first 1,000 addresses. If you want to increase customer retention, grow your market presence, track your statistics, and improve your engagement with your customers with modern, elegant emails that express the personality of your business with emails that integrate with your website, you need to contact AdLocal, and they handle the rest. Take it from me. AdLocal offers the best solutions for all organization sizes, and they lead with their pricing and the 24-hour customer service. Folks, it's time to call AdLocal at 866-88-ADD-LOCAL or visit them on the web at www.addlocal.com. To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. And so that was kind of powerful. I think it is important to just kind of reread that, because we were going out, and I know that there was maybe some confusion or what have you. So let me just read the last part again. Therefore, from theory and practice, it may be concluded that this government with special powers, without any express exceptions, is better than a government with general powers and special exceptions. But the practice of England is against us. The rights, because they're talking about this concept of a Bill of Rights being applied to general powers. Why, you know, the reason why you need a Bill of Rights is because in England, the king had general powers. That's why we had a Bill of Rights. They changed, they undid this. They took a whole new paradigm and said, we're only delegating these powers. This is it. You can only do these things. So you don't need to worry about religion. You don't need to worry about the press. You don't need to worry about common law. You don't need to worry about any of these things. They only have the power over these and jurisdiction over these powers. The rights there reserved to the people are to limit and check the king's prerogative. It is easier to enumerate the exceptions to his prerogative than to mention all the cases to which it extends. Besides, these reservations being only formed in acts of the legislature may be altered by the representatives of the people when they think proper. No comparison can be made of this with the other governments he mentioned. There is no stipulation between the king and the people. The former, the king, is possessed of absolute unlimited authority, which is why you hope to have a Bill of Rights, because then you're at least guarded by a long maxim that says these things the king can't touch. However, by granting the federal government very specific powers, these are the only things the government can touch. And that's it. That's the beautiful thing about our Constitution. But, sir, this Constitution is defective because the common law is not declared to be enforced. Now, this, again, is George Nicholas. And he's, again, you know, going back and poking Henry in the eye, and all of these people have talked about common law. He says, but, sir, this Constitution is defective because the common law is not to be declared in force. What would have been the consequence if it had? It would be immutable. In other words, if it declared common law, then there wouldn't be any ability to create a new law or any better law, not just civil law, but anything better. But now it can be changed or modified as the legislative body may find necessary for the community. But the common law is not excluded. There is nothing in that paper to warrant the assertion. As to the exclusion of a jury from the vicinage, he has mistaken the fact. The legislature may direct a jury to come from the vicinage, but the gentleman says that by this Constitution, they have power to make laws to define crimes and prescribe punishments, and that, consequently, we are not free from torture. Treason against the United States is defined in the Constitution, and the forfeiture limited to the life of the person attainted. Congress have power to define and punish piracies and felonies committed on the high seas and offenses against laws of nation. But they cannot, and I got to emphasize this, but they cannot define or prescribe the punishment of any other crime, whatever, without the violating of the Constitution. Do you understand? In other words, kidnapping, drug laws, every law, you have to show me the amendment to the Constitution delegating Congress and the federal government the power over these types of laws and crimes. And because it doesn't happen and hasn't happened, here you have it. They cannot define or prescribe the punishment of any other crime whatever without violating the Constitution. If we had no security against torture but our Declaration of Rights, we might be tortured tomorrow, for it had been repeatedly infringed and disregarded. A Bill of Rights is only an acknowledgement of the pre-existing claims to the rights in the people. They belong to us as much as if they had been inserted in the Constitution. But it is said that if, I want you to understand this, they belong to us as much as they have been inserted into, as if they had been inserted into the Constitution. Trying to make the point here. Forgive me for the airy head a little bit. Now, I'll explain it in a coming episode. But what you have to garner out of this is that as Englishmen, they considered the Bill of Rights an inheritable, just like the Declaration, that we were endowed inalienable rights. Those rights of an Englishman are granted to us, and the Constitution was designed to preserve those. But it is said that if it be doubtful, the possibility of dispute ought to be precluded. Admitting it was proper for the convention to have inserted a Bill of Rights, it is not proper here to propose it as the condition of our accession to the Union. Would you reject this government for its omission, dissolve the Union, and bring miseries on yourself and your posterity? I hope the gentleman does not oppose it on the ground solely. Is there another reason, he said, that it is not the general wish of this state, but all of the states, to have a Bill of Rights? If it be so, where is the difficulty of having this done by the way of a subsequent amendment? We shall find the other states willing to accord with their own favorite wish. The gentleman last up says the power of legislation includes everything. A general power of legislation does, but this is a special power of legislation. Therefore, it does not contain the plenitude of power, and there's a good word for you, plenitude of power, which he imagines. So plenitude is, you know, one of those, you know, all powerful. They have the unlimited power. They cannot legislate in any case, but those particularly enumerated. No gentleman who is a friend to the government ought to withhold his assent from it for this reason. And so they go on, and Mr. Madison steps in and starts talking about exclusive legislation. And so this is what he says. Madison was surprised that any gentleman should return to the clause which had already been discussed. He begged the gentleman to read the clause which gave the power of exclusive legislation, and he might see that nothing could be done without the consent of the states. With respect to the opposed operation of what was denominated the sweeping clause, the gentleman, he said, was mistaken, for it only extended to the enumerated powers. Should Congress attempt to extend it to any power not enumerated, it would be warranted by the clause. As to the restriction in the clause under consideration, it was a restraint on the exercise of power expressly delegated to Congress, namely that of regulating commerce and foreign nations. Actually, I want to reread this. As to the restriction in the clause under consideration, it was a restraint to the exercise of power expressly delegated to Congress, namely that of regulating commerce with foreign nations. Now, so this is where they were really getting into the power of regulating commerce. Congress, I told you several times, Congress's responsibility in regulating commerce was with foreign nations, not between the states. They were an agent in making sure that one state couldn't do unfair practices with another state. Let's say Michigan started building cars, and Michigan started exporting these cars, and they started selling these cars in every state. All of a sudden, California came up with environmental standards and said, hey, you can't build these cars unless you build them to this standard. That would be a violation of the Commerce Clause. Now, it's one thing to get Michigan to, we agree that these environmental things are important and we want to be on top of that and create a consensus and maybe even amend the Constitution in granting the power to the federal government to be able to regulate the environment. Thank heavens we didn't do that. Thank heavens that is still an unconstitutional role, responsibility, and power. It was strictly an assumed power that they took upon themselves and that they mandated upon all states. Just so you understand, there is no enumerated power for the environment. And so this is one of the reasons why, because of environmental purposes and so forth, they have started regulating commerce specifically. I mean, the federal government can't do these things, and there's no power given to them. I mean, when you start really looking at the enumerated powers and this concept of being an agent in ensuring one state treats the other state equally regarding commerce, they can't start invoking environmental reasons because that's not a power that they have delegated to them. Anyway. Now, what we do want to see is we'd like to see the states actually become the agents for all domestic issues, which was the whole design of our constitutional republic. States should have that. And if the states want to create a strategy, a standard, the states can actually do that in creating a domestic polity in doing so. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.